for you to tell the political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
We're poor, we're poor, Ashe.
Ashe.
We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We poor to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren and their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with the Dinka symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves, became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York, we pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Martin Luther
King, John Henry Clark, John
Dr.
G. Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Wrote the book of the seventh seal. Who's that writing, John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Well, who's that writing? John the Revelator wrote the book of the seven seas. You know, God walked down in the cool of the day, called Adam by his name, and he refused to answer because he's naked and ashamed. Who's that writing? John the Revelator. Who's that writing? John the Revelator. Who's that writing? John the Revelator wrote the book of the seventh seal. You know, Christ had 12 apostles, and 3 he led away. Say, watch with me 1 hour till I go yon and pray. Tell me who's that writing? John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Who's that writing, John the Revelator. Wrote the book of the seven seas. Who's that writing, John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Who's that writing, John the Revelator. Wrote the book of the seven seas. Christ came on the Easter morning. Mary and Martha was there to see. Go tell my disciples to meet me in Galilee. Tell me who's writing, John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Wrote the book of the seventh seal. Who's that writing? John the Revelator. Who's that writing? John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing? John the Revelator wrote the book of the seventh seal.
Hotep, and good afternoon, my brothers and my sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. My name is Dr. William Rogers, and I am here as your host on this wonderful Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday evening. We appreciate all of you, as always, for your participation. For you, our listening audience, it would not be a Black Reality Think Tank without you. We thank you so much for you do and your continued patronage over the years. We have been now on the air close to about 7 years, and we really, really do appreciate you supporting this program and this idea. We have a very dynamic and invigorating discussion for you this evening. We're going to get into that in just a few minutes. A lot going on in our world. I think maybe as we speak, you've got impeachment hearings, which I call a poppycock. But that's nevertheless, they are happening. We may mention a few things about that today. But also, we have some other things. We always sitting on the brink of war, Terry, but very clearly our world is a lot of friction going on. And obviously there is love and joy sometimes in some places among us. And so tonight we are going to talk about vision. What do we see? This is 2020. 2020 is vision. It's about vision. And so we want to be able to speak on that tonight and see where we need to be and understand the Black experience as it relates to the concept of vision. You know, I used to always often, I remember coming up, being raised as a young boy in the South in the early 50s and the 60s. And it was a very strong community, a lot different than what it is today. In my household, there was my parents, then there were my grandparents lived there. And I remember my grandfather was a very spiritual and religious kind of guy, but old-fashioned. He worked for the city of Durham, North Carolina. He worked on highways and the streets. He dug ditches. And he was a hardcore laborer. And I remember that. He was a church man. I remember on Sunday morning, he would get me up, and I'd have to go to Sunday school with him. And he was kind of like they call it a Sunday school librarian. But nonetheless, what it was, I got a chance to soak up some of that wisdom from people like him and others. And one of the things that they always talked about a lot, they talked about the Old Testament. And at that, you know, being young, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, don't quite know what all that meant. But I used to listen, and particularly he used to talk about the book of Revelations. And I knew that it was in the Bible, but again, I'm 7, 8 years old, so I don't really know that much. But I don't even talk about apocalyptic literature and the horses and the seven seals. And it always used to fascinate me. And then I remember one time I was cleaning up our house, and my father was a school teacher, and he used to have a lot of books. And I remember looking at this book that said something about Revelations, looking at the book of Daniel and Revelations. And again, you know, 9, 10-year-old kid, not quite knowing what all that meant, but I used to sit there and look at those pictures. There were a lot of pictures in there, drawings exactly. And over the years, as I developed, I began to see more and more people were engaged into that. And one of the first strong organizations that I acclimated to was the Nation of Islam. And I recall them quite often speaking from the Old Testament and talking about a lot of the literature that used to come out of the Old Testament and what it meant, the book of the story of Ezekiel and some of those other kinds of literature like that, Elijah, you know. And it was a very powerful experience for me. And I was happy to, as I said, be able to be inundated with that kind of wisdom and knowledge. And so over the years, I then began to study that as I got older, and I studied it more and understood what the stories like climbing Jacob's ladder, the book of the seven seals, and so forth and so on, what a lot of that meant. And a lot of that was African wisdom. It came out of the annals of African history. And obviously it was placed into the Christian Bible along with the New Testament, but very clearly that has a long history. But nevertheless, that Old Testament was different. And as those of you who have read it and knew it. And so a lot of that was about vision. and visionary messages. And a lot of those prophets of that time were telling the stories of vision. I was talking to my brother earlier today who pastors a church in North Carolina, and he was talking about he's going to be delivering his annual church message to his congregation. He's going to talk about vision. And it just kind of inspired me, and he and I had been talking about it even prior to that, to go in and look at it, because this is 2020. 2020 is relegated usually to eyesight. Somebody who has 20/20 vision has basically very good eyesight, and I don't know who set that scale up or who and how they did it or why they did it and what it meant. All I know is that if you went to the eye doctor and they said your vision is 20/20, then you know you were straight. You see, so this year is 2020, and there's a lot of stories. And today in the promotion of this program, I placed two clippings. I think to my brother, my dear brother, Brother Muhammad, who reminded me about the one in the book of Genesis. I knew about the one that was in the book of, by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Message to the Black Man. And all of these spoke of the idea of the 400 years of captivity by the Africans and what would happen at the end of that 400 years. And based on the American system of captivity, that would be 2020. And so anyway, tonight I thought I'd talk a little bit about that. I called a few of my community scholars, the others I know would know about it anyway, to go ask them to what they thought about it and would they chat in and offer some suggestions and how they see it. As you remember, this is the Black Reality Think Tank. So we're here to think about ideas that would obviously generate solutions. And that's what we are going to do today. But before I do that, I have two things I want to do before we start. There was a young lady that was supposed to come on, but I don't see her now, so we may have to just move on. But let me first of all, do what we always normally do, and hopefully by the time she may come back on. Okay, I see her now. we do our ancestral profile. You know, we stand on the shoulders of greatness, as Dr. Carr said in his libations. You know, we can never forget our ancestors. Never, ever, ever, ever. And don't do it. Don't wait and think about them in February. Then you need to think about them 365 days a year. So it's not that. And so that's why here on the Black Reality Think Tank, every program we do a protest. We do a tribute to our ancestors to honor them. We try to do some that you're very familiar with. We try to do some that maybe you may not be quite familiar with. Tonight I want to do a brother who has done some powerful economic work back in the years of yore, in the days of yore. He's a strong brother. Not a lot of people know about him. I was able to. I think one of we have a great community panel and group of scholars that work with us here. They're always coming up with ideas and suggestions. And I think this came from my brother from Montgomery, Alabama, Brother Lush, sent this name to me. And anyway, I followed up on it, and I found some information about him that appeared in a magazine, an online magazine, African-American magazine called Afropunk. And the writer's name was T. McLendon, and I want to give him the credit. And this is the profile that's there. So tonight, we want to talk about him and talk about his an economic contribution, because we're talking about tonight in terms of vision as it relates to politics and economics. So I thought this would be an appropriate profile to do. We're looking at a brother who was obviously an enslaved, captured African. His name was William Washington Brown. William Washington Brown. He was the first to start a black-owned financial institution with the help of one of the first black fraternal orders, which was the Grand United Order of True Reformers. And think about that now. The name of this fraternal organization was called the Grand United Order of True Reformers. Mr. Brown was born into captivity. He was born as Ben Brown. He was born in Habersham County, Georgia, on October the 20th, 1849. He was born to Joseph Brown, who was his father, and Mariah Brown, and he was sold to a horse trader at the age of 8 years old. After this sale, Brown changed his name to William Washington. And as a young adult, Brown escaped his owners during the Civil War, and he joined the Union Army, where he remained until he was discharged from service in 1862. After his discharge, Brown attended school in Wisconsin and began a teaching position in the South, during which time he met and married his wife, Mary A. Graham. Brown's philosophy in life and in his activism was complete independence. Check this out, my brothers and sisters. Complete independence from white people. He wanted as many black people as humanely possible to live without depending on the white community, especially economic and financially speaking. To that end, Brown created a bank. He established insurance and assisted his community to buy land and property. And as a former enslaved African and proponent of the temperance movement, he was an outspoken opponent of the Ku Klux Klan and helped campaign against them in both word and deed. William Washington Brown embodies the resilience, the forethought, the excellence, and the fortitude in his creating the first ever black-owned bank. And he opened the door for institutions of all kinds to be owned by black people. William Washington Brown is a hidden figure no more. As I said, this article was written by T. McClendon in an online publication called Afro Punk. Very dynamic brother. I went and looked further for some things, and there's a lot more on him. You might want to try Googling that. There's a lot of other things about him. But this is the kind of brother that we're talking about tonight. This is the kind of foresight and vision that we are going to address and ask ourselves as African people, are we ready? Do we have that kind of vision? This is 2020 vision. And I don't think there's anybody out here who's listening to me at the sound of my voice that does not agree that this is 2020 vision. And this is what we are looking at. And if we don't have it, how do we get it? And what do we need to do? Okay. I think I introduced to you a couple of weeks back when we were talking about Kwanzaa. We were talking about looking at some of those principles of Kwanzaa and how important they were and putting them into operation. And what we wanted to do and what we did do on that program is we gave you examples of how we can do Umoja, how we can do the Kuchichagalia, the Ujima, and the Udama, how we can do those things and what are examples of putting that to work. And I introduced you to a young lady out of Dallas, Texas, that had a powerful organization called Soul Sister Stand Up. And one of the reasons I promote this organization so heavily, because those of you who know me and we have talked personally in philosophy, you know what I feel about the womb. The womb is the incubator of the black community. And if we don't protect the womb, we won't have a community. And so I have been pushing that idea for a long, long time because it's the womb that produces our offspring, our future, the prodigy of our hope. And that comes only through the black woman. We have a job that we do in there. We're part of the structure, too, as well. She's not alone in producing it. But one of the things we have to do is care for it. And so this organization, and there are others like this too. I'm not just saying that this is not the only one. You've got organizations that I know of, for instance, here in Milwaukee called the Sojourner Truth House. So many other women organizations like that. That was actually a women's organizational movement at the early turn of the 20th century, led by people like Mary Church Terrell, Mary McLeod Bethune, powerful, powerful black women who were trying to do some of the same things that this organization was trying to do. And sometimes we as brothers are not quite as sensitive as we should be. But anyway, they're working in Dallas. They have a transitional house program that they are trying to put together for women who may be destitute or may be caught into the crossfire of things and need somewhere to relax, lay their head with their children, just replenish themselves so they can get back out there into the game of life and take care of these children and raise our community. So I wanted to give her another opportunity to come forward because they are having something, and just let her make a very quick announcement about something that they are having. And so for those of you out there who are listening, please get your pen and pencils. She's going to ask you for your help on something that they're trying to do. And again, this is why I do it, because of the fact that this is dealing with the womb. So, Sister Lotus J, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Dr. Rogers?
Good, great. Thank you. So let our audience know what you got going.
So, Sister Stand Up, again, Dr. Rogers has done a really good job of explaining what we are about. And our primary goal is to unify women as we go through transitional situations and challenging situations, and show the importance of coming together and working together collectively. So right now what we're doing, we have an immediate need for our headquarters, for our organization, which is also serves as our communal living home. So we're currently working on a fundraiser. It is a raffle. Anybody in the country can participate. Tickets are $25 for five tickets. So you get five tickets for $25. And there are different items that will be raffled off, such as the newest iPhone, a 50-inch TV, $100 cash prize, as well as a care package from, and a Sage package from Universal Purpose, which is a store that is local. Again, anyone in the country can participate. You can pay via Cash App, via PayPal. You can just go and do a donation on our website, and we will ship you the prizes if you win. We'll write your names on your tickets, and if you're in Milwaukee, we'll get them up there to you as well. So definitely asking for your support. We're doing what we know how to do to unify and come together. Not a feminist movement at all. However, we are teaching women the importance of living out the village concept.
Right. All right. And so if they do want to purchase a ticket and participate in this this raffle, how would they do? Because normally you get a raffle, you get a ticket, and you got a number on it, and then there's a drawing. When is the drawing, and how does that work?
The drawing is going to be on February 1st. It will be here in DFW. However, it will be on Facebook Live, so everyone will be able to participate in the drawing. You do not have to be present to win. You can get tickets through our website. You can get tickets. We're on Facebook as well as Instagram. Our Facebook, all of our information is Soul Sister Stand Up. The reason it's Stand Up is it is a call to action. We're asking everyone to unite, and that's what we're asking you to do with this fundraiser as well. So you can go to any of our information, and if it's okay with Dr. Rogers, we can post it on his page. If not, he can maybe share a link on his page as to how you can get to my page. And that way you can go ahead and do it right there online. You can give us a call. Our information is on there, the phone number. Our website is soulsistas.org. That's soulsistas.org. So all of our information is there as well.
Okay, now you did an acronym, and I don't think right now, particularly online, I mean on our switchboard, nobody's on from Dallas. What is that acronym? You said VFW.
Dallas Fort Worth.
Okay, all right. So Dallas Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then suppose that there are individuals that don't have access to your Facebook page and won't be able to see it. How can they go on and look if they are not connected to your system of Facebook? How can they?
Well, anybody can see us on Facebook. We're not a private page. So if you go to our page, it's anyone that has access. And again, it's Soul Sisters Stand Up. Soul Sisters Stand Up. That is our group. Our Facebook page, our telephone number is 817-680-0782. Again, our website is foulistahs.org. You have several different ways where you can get in touch with us.
Okay, and so again, this fundraiser, just so that once more we're clear, this fundraiser is designed to do what?
This fundraiser is we're raising funds for our communal living home to help us with the communal living home and the women that stay here, as well as just other programs with the organization.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, I wish you God's bless. I think you will be blessed. Matter of fact, I know you will. And I look forward to, by all means, you letting us know. I'll have you come back on after the drawing is over and indicate to our audience, you know, how it turned out, and obviously anything else that you're going to be doing as well. So we thank you so much. Bless you. You can stick around by all means and listen to our program. We're talking about vision and what a lot of that means. And we welcome you to do that. Thank you so much, Lotus J.
Yes, thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. All right. Okay, my brothers and sisters, the name of our program tonight is What is the Economic and Political Vision for the African-American Community in 2020? That is our point. And let me read to you what I posted also, so that, because I want to start off by responding to this piece that I wrote. And just so that he can be on the alert, I'm going to come to you first, my brother from Philadelphia. I'm going to come to you first. And there's a reason I'm coming to you first, and you obviously see why. Okay. In the book of Genesis, and Brother Rick Muhammad posted this earlier today on his website, and it reminded me of it, so I incorporated this. Thank you, Brother Rick, for reminding me of this piece. The first quote that I want to look at, it comes from the book of the Old Testament, book of Genesis, in the 15th chapter, the 13th, 14th verse. He said, "The devil reared the poor so-called Negroes for 400 years and put fear in them when they were babies." And this is obviously paraphrased, and it was from not actually the actual scripture, but it's paraphrased. They, the devils, kept them apart from their own kind, coming in from abroad, so as to deprive them of any knowledge other than what he, the devil, has taught them. I read it one more time. The devil reared the poor so-called Negroes for 400 years and put fear in them when they were babies. They, the devils, kept them apart from their own kind, coming in from abroad, so as to deprive them of any knowledge other than what he, the devil, has taught them. That is, you know what, I'm sorry. That quote comes from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's book, Message to the Black Man. That's not the book of Genesis. I'm looking at the reading wrong. So let me make sure I'm clear again. Let me go back to, I apologize for that. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in his book, Message to the Black Man, wrote that the devils reared the poor so-called Negroes for 400 years and put fear in them when they were babies. They, the devils, kept them apart from their own kind, coming in from abroad, so as to deprive them of any knowledge other than what the devil has taught them themselves. This is from Elijah Muhammad's book, Message to the Black Man. Now, the book of Genesis, Old Testament, Genesis 15, 13 through 14. 13 says, let me just silence some of that noise quickly in the background. If you don't, we got some background noise, and let me just do that. Those of you who are online, just let me be mindful that, you know, your mics sometimes are open, or they are open, and so it very clearly all any distraction whatsoever will be picked up in that background noise. Okay, let me go back. Some reason they don't want me to read this real smoothly. But anyway, let me go to the book of Genesis, the Old Testament, 15, 13 through 14. It says, "Then the Lord said to him, 'Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country, not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But if I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. So, two passages. One from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, book, Message to the Black Man, and one from the Old Testament, dealing with that 400-year concept. So, to start our conversation off, Brother Timothy, and I know that, and you know why I'm asking you, because obviously, you know, you have a member of the Nation of Islam. What have you been taught the meaning of, particularly the Honorable Elijah Muhammad statement, and correlating that to the biblical passage in the Old Testament? What is your understanding of those two as it relates to vision? Brother Timothy?
Yes. Dr. Rogers?
Yes, sir.
How are you, sir?
Oh,
I missed that. I'm sorry. Brother?
Did you hear me well? Did you hear my question?
I'm sorry. I missed it, sir. We were disconnected for... What was the question again, sir?
Okay. All right. It's a long question. Let me come back to you, okay? And then we can...
Come back.
Okay. Brother Pugh, we talked about it already. You know what I was going to say about that. What's your point? What is your viewpoint with those two passages in terms of as it relates to talking today about vision?
Well, I was hoping for Timothy because I'm ignorant, man. I'm not familiar with the passages other than hearing you say them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more... I don't know if they're prophecy or I don't know, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not,
okay.
You know, I'm not, you know, so I, you know, I don't have any clue. So
okay.
I'm,
all right.
You know,
what, and
I'm
that's,
interested,
that, that's
you know,
a good so. Point. That's a good point. So, so let me go back just again, because they are more. And again, as I started my conversation on our program tonight, talking about the fact that, we are looking at prophecy and prophecy, and the prophesying we find in scriptures and all ancient texts come from men and women of vision. They are looking at things and they are relating that for the generations that are coming. And these are two specific ones that some would argue relate right to African people. So I'm going to read them again. Brother Timothy said he didn't hear that. The first one comes from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in his book, Message to the Black Man. He said, the devils reared the poor so-called Negroes for 400 years and put fear in them when they were babies. They, the devils, kept them apart from their own kind, coming in from abroad so as to deprive them of any knowledge other than what he, the devil, has taught them. And then in the book of Genesis, it says, then the Lord said unto him, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not of their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. Verse 14 says, but I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possession. So the question I'm raising is, do these two passages, do we have the 2020 vision to understand, first of all, these messages? And are we able to take them and be able to build and heal our community? And that's kind of where I wanted to start with tonight. And so that's what I'm doing. And I've chosen two specific focuses. One, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who taught much about the Old Testament and has brought that into operation. And the other one that comes directly from the Old Testament. So now, Brother Timothy, what do you think?
Oh, yes. I just caught it now. And you've been breaking up on my line.
Okay.
You may be clear speaking, but it's breaking up on the other end. You know, the messenger taught us that every 25,000 years, the poles change from north to south. And he said, a man writes his history and lived it. We always talk about, what is he saying? In other words, he's saying that the Jews that are talked about in the Bible are us today. And what we see with Cecil B. DeMille and all those things that they put on television, that they're to come.
Right.
And they're to come. It hasn't happened yet. So when they speak of a strange people in a strange land taken from one place to another, he said, it's about us. So his prophecy said that we are right now in bondage looking to be taken out. Now, some people took that different ways. So, in other words, what we see of that we thought happened is either happening now or is going to happen.
Okay. And those are the prophecies, right? Okay.
So he said, wait a minute. He also said things about Ezekiel's wheel, a wheel was outside a wheel. He spoke of the mothership. And those things in the nation were, for some people, kind of hard to comprehend. Because when he talked about Yaku, some people who come in the nation said, but look, I can't accept Yaku. Other people come and say, well, I can't even accept the mothership. Some people can't say, well, you mean to tell me that we're the people right now in bondage trying to get out? So I'm going to make that connection. Now, I've heard Malcolm in his speeches talk about it. I've heard Farrakhan talk about prophecy all the time. He doesn't do it as much as he did in the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I can relate to it. And whether they were talking, whether it was allegorical, whether it was symbolic, whether it was like you and I always talk about the way that you would tell a story. But I can relate to it because when, I think it was in the 80s, when they asked Mahatma Begin, and they said, don't you like what your people built, these pyramids? He said, my people have no record of building that.
Okay.
So it puts you in a mind frame of, and there are people, I've heard Father Divine do some things on his tape.
Oh, yeah, all of
I've them. Heard, wow. Noble Drew Ali, all those men could teach mysticism. And they were like, and they were so great. They were like from another planet. And where they would, but they would also unlock the bondage in the mind of the slave master today. It puts you on another level. One thing I think the Honorable Elijah Muhammad did for me is he broke the slave chains of white supremacy and brought me on another level to make me know that the original man is first. I could take it from there. Everybody who was under him took things differently. As a matter of fact, I don't think a lot of people understand what he was saying. That's why they went with Elijah Muhammad and got lost. That's another story.
Right, right. Yeah, it is. It is. And see, that's why I wanted to, because these are prophecies in a lot of cases given to us as people now to move upon. And we somehow or the other, are we having the vision to see them and obviously respond to them? Or are we saying, man, right, what are you talking about that mess for? They ain't got nothing to do with nothing. You know, or where are we on that? And that's where the vision piece comes in. In another part of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is full with messages about vision. In the book of Proverbs, it talks about no vision, and we perish. Obviously, people who are not able to see, you know, and our ancestors tried to tell us that. Our grandparents told us that, tried to tell us that. Our parents prophesied to us. Sometimes they prophesied to us in discussion. Other times they prophesized to us with a belt. And I remember both of them.
True.
I remember the belt one and the regular prophesying. But I had to listen to that about life and understanding. And so today, you know, we sophisticated and got technology and we all claim that we woke and we smart and we know everything. So we ain't listening to that no more. You know, I ain't hear all that. You know, I know what I know. I know what I'm talking about. That's that old stuff. You know, I don't talk about no revelations. What that mean? We ain't got nothing to do with nothing. About some horses. That's white folks stuff. You know where we go with that. You heard us rip that kind of stuff apart. But these.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. Uh-huh. Just recently, Dr. Rogers, I heard a tape on Martin Luther King. And he had brought me right to the mindset of what you're talking about.
Right.
Now, I thought he was like, oh, God. You know, he's done some things. You know, a lot of people don't know all he did. We didn't hear, like the speech he did at that church in Riverside.
Right, right. Oh yeah.
Riverside.
Uh-huh.
Familiar with that?
In New York. Yeah, the one in the big church in New York.
Riverside Church.
Uh-huh.
He also did a speech, and when he talked about him and Elijah Muhammad, they never play it.
Of course not.
He also, right, he also did some work with the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the way, you know, King was deeper, much deeper than what, you know, I'm going to tell you something, man. He was on another planet. You know, he, him and Malcolm, both. But yeah. King could take you out of here.
They had
and
that
put you
vision.
On another level.
They had he that was, 2020
if you,
vision.
If you talk about the etherical plane, he went on another level with the ether, with the etherical plane. Him and Malcolm.
Right.
But King could really take you there, and so could Malcolm. They were special people.
Okay.
Who were taught by special people.
Right. Right. And these messages were designed to wake us up and to be prepared. And, I mean, they've come in dreams, as stories of folk who have picked up. And this is, again, having some connection to spirituality and spiritualness, which is really who we come from. Because when we look at the religion of Ifa, it's not religion, the practice of Ifa, and a lot of the Yoruba culture out of traditional Africa. You see that, you know, we have to do some real serious reading and research in order to help ourselves, because that's all been designed to get us through. And we keep asking ourselves about why this ain't happening and why God ain't doing this and why he letting us suffer. And I think about the story of Habakkuk in the Old Testament, where he's claiming to God, complaining to God that the Chaldeans was beating up on them and they was doing this, and I thought you said we were your children and you were our God, but you letting them beat up on us like that. And as the story goes, he told Habakkuk in so many words, he didn't say it in the scripture, just shut up and go sit up there on top of the mountain and let me talk to you and keep quiet. You know, we blah, blah, blah too much about things. And so these visions are designed for us to see some things. And you may not see them. It's not everybody going to see into the depth of what they mean and what they are. But I've been hearing these two quotes, the one from Elijah Muhammad and that one of the Old Testament and that one in Proverbs all my life as a child. Sometimes I listened, sometimes I didn't. You know, it depends. And these are the kinds of things that we are saying today. As we're facing some difficult times, you know, and there's a vision that has told us this, you know, we very well may end up in a major conflict with Iran or somebody or a couple of them. I don't think it's Iran by themselves. I think they're just the front voice piece, but there may be some folk behind that. You know, they're being called to play the chips. And if that does happen, that's going to be, that's not going to come out any winners. And so we're being warned of that, you know.
That's true.
That's right. Well,
so, I'm going to say this, Dr. Rogers, you don't mind. If you ever hear King speak about the bombing in the church, and he talks about the four little princesses. I think that's wonderful.
Right.
He talks about the four little princesses that were killed.
Uh-huh.
And then when he talks about the letter from Birmingham, when he wrote it from prison,
yeah,
now,
a powerful piece.
And the way
powerful
he piece. Articulates in right. that letter,
right, right,
you know he was somewhere else.
Right.
And one time he talked about traveling, and he said that he had to start off, he said he would start from the ancient Greek and Roman time, he would move.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said he would stop at the emancipation, he said he would move. Then he would say he would go from that.
Yeah, I remember.
He goes on, and you say this, he ain't here.
That's powerful.
And if he talks about, and then you go to Malcolm, and Malcolm would talk about, you know, if Jesus was a Muslim, he said if Lot taught freedom, justice, and equality, and Jesus taught must freedom, justice, and Moses did, and Abraham. He said they all taught that.
Right.
They were speaking about Islam. That depends on your interpretation, what you got.
Right.
Malcolm would take you after a while off the planet.
Right. Exactly.
With special men who were taught by special people.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and
That's why our teachers are so valuable. Our teachers are valuable.
We didn't want them to go, but they went.
Right.
And see, we have people who, I'm going to tell you, I believe that Mahatma Gandhi got there in his country.
Right.
I think different people got there. Jesus of 2,000 years ago got there.
Right.
Moses, Lot.
Yep.
Elijah Muhammad, Father Divine, mm-hmm. Daddy Grace. Certain people got there.
Right. And you know, Brother Timothy, and I appreciate all your remarks, that these are the things that that have to encompass the vision concept, as you said. You know, you named some very powerful names and powerful ancestors who did that. I wonder sometimes, did we really hear Marcus Garvey when he said toward the end of his life, when he was had gone through his capture and deported back to Jamaica, he said, "I will catch you in the whirlwind." And how many of us have looked at that and tried to decipher what that meant? He was giving you a message. That was a vision message in that statement. "I will catch you in the whirlwind." I may be paraphrasing it just a bit. It may not be his exact words. But what does he mean by catch you in the whirlwind? You know, and I used to ponder that. I said, what is that talking about? So I had to study it. I went and studied it. And we'll talk about that on another program. I want to get to that. But let me go over here to my brother Herbie White and ask him, you know, because he's a visionary. Very clearly, I think that. And then I'm going to go over here to my sister Benicia and see if she's ready to give us her thoughts on this visionary process. Brother White, what you think about those statements from Elijah Muhammad as well as from the Old Testament? Brother Herbie? Oh, and I may not have. This may not be. 919-768. Okay. Maybe just listening. Then do that. Sister Benicia, any thoughts?
Yes. First, I want to give you the greetings. How are you?
Oh, I'm wonderful. How are you doing?
All right. Greetings, Brother Timothy. And anybody else that might be on the line.
Right.
And listening. So as you, when you initially started talking about the Old Testament, I said, ick, you know, yicky
right.
Yick.
I know. Most people do.
Because it's so, you know, I started reading the Old Testament, and there's so much violence in that book, and the God, you know, of the people that constructed that book is so violent and so savage, you know? I was turned off. But I said I want to read it through anyway because I want to understand this book that, you know, the devil used to control us, to control our minds especially. But then when you talked about Elijah Muhammad, start listening a little more, and then you talked about Garvey, and then I said, okay, putting those three things together makes sense. You know, visionaries, those prophets that see, you know, like you and Brother Timothy were saying, more and deeper, way deeper than the average person can see.
Right.
So people, my observation of people, unfortunately, we have wonderful visionaries. But people don't listen. People don't listen to the prophets.
Oh, no.
And they don't listen to the visionaries.
No, they don't.
Yeah, it's just in general. Some may put some energy and focus, but in general, humans don't pay attention. And I think that is part of why we suffer, because we don't pay attention, we don't prepare. But I'll tell you who is preparing for the end times, and that is the white evangelicals.
Okay.
They're preparing for these end time prophecies. They're building bunkers, you know, underneath the ground to hide from, you know, Armageddon and to have a safe space to go. They're selling dried foods that'll last for 2 years, you know. They're teaching people how to filter water. You know, they're packing up their guns and all their, you know, weaponry, which they love so much. They're preparing.
Right.
I've seen a lot of this.
Right.
and all, I'm just all over. All you gotta do is look at the, you know, the, what do you call them, the TV shows, you know, those Christian TV shows.
Right.
Yeah, they're promoting this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they're promoting. And who's not preparing are the people that are victimized, and that's us.
Right.
So whether the visions, you know, and prophecies are true or not, you know, I still struggle a little bit with biblical stuff because there's some spiritual truth, and then there's a bunch of just craziness in there that I cannot stomach. But whether they're true or not, we're not preparing adequately. Right. And so, you know, that's what brings me to the point that I made initially. People don't listen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, human beings typically have to suffer and get beaten down and either find their way back up, you know, like that valley of dry bones, you know, somehow pull themselves back together, or they get extinguished.
Okay. Okay.
So, you know, my question to us, to mm-hmm. black folk, would be, you know, which one will we do?
Mm-hmm.
Because you have two other points I want to make quickly. As I look at the Hebrew Israelites,
right.
I think they're talking a lot about the prophecy, correct?
Yeah, they do a lot of the Old Testament.
Yeah, and they're crazy as hell.
Mm-hmm.
They're crazy. They're crazy. They're violent. Not all, of course, but most of what I see is a complete turnoff. So I don't think they really get it.
Okay.
Because they're just raging at people. You know, if you truly understand a prophecy or vision, then you get busy building. You know, not raging at people. So that's what I've seen with a lot of them. And then for the thousands and thousands of black Christians that I see, they believe in the end time prophecies. You know, they absolutely believe. So across the board with Christians, I've seen the belief. But blacks and whites do two different things. So black folk, typically I hear, well, we just wait to be taken up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we just wait for Jesus to come and blow that horn and come on a cloud and take us on up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so basically bury your head in the sand, you know, watch your children get killed off. Well, you know, that's just in the prophecy while whites are preparing.
Okay.
And I think that's really, really important for us to take a serious look at.
You know, one of the things here on the Black Reality Think Tank that we don't try to do is we don't try to convince anybody to believe something specifically. We just present what's available in front of us and discuss it like you have done just now in terms of that. I think one of the things from my perspective in my areas of study and research is that we have looked at the Old Testament incorrectly. We have looked at it as a spiritual book, and that's not what it was. It was... It obviously, the Christian church incorporated, but the Old Testament was around long before there ever was anything called Christianity. So it was just simply put into the Christianity publication by those who were restructuring the religion and trying to empower the religion. And the behavior that you saw a lot of times in the Old Testament is actually, and from my perspective, compatible to what you see in 2020. When you take a bomb and you wipe out a whole nation, I don't know if there's anything, and obviously because of the technology, if there's anything in the Old Testament that compares to that type of behavior. When you go into a continent and you seize millions and millions of its people, place them in captivity, throw them in the holes of a slave ship, you know, that's designed to hold 100 people, and you put 600 in there, hoping that the ones that will die will give you enough so that when you get the land, you will have enough to sell. That type of behavior, the Old Testament stories of folk like that by the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, the Assyrians, and the Persians are equal to that, or if not worse. So if we turn up our nose at the Old Testament, because there's a lot of violence in that, then we need to turn up our nose at everything that has been written in the 20th century that we've read, because it's just as brutal. And all of our studies and things that we've looked at and people that have written, Toni Morrison's book, James Baldwin's book, these are, if the Old Testament's brutal, then that's brutal. Because it's only telling us the story of the behavior of the human animal on the planet Earth. That's really what it does. So I think if we look at the Old Testament like that, it gives us that picture as opposed to trying to read it to get some kind of spiritual enlightenment. You know, the spiritual enlightenment comes from inside of you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's where we get that. The New Testament doesn't do it either necessarily that way, or any book, you know. And I'm not lambasting anybody's religious sources, whether it's the Bhagavad Gita, the Rig Veda, the New Testament, that the Torah, the Quran, whatever. None of that is designed so much just to help you understand the process of the planet, of the behavior of the human animal on the planet Earth. I think that's really what it does. And it was written by people closer to the times that it was happening. So as they wrote the story, even the Valley of the Dry Bones may be a symbolic story, but I know some dry bone places. I know, you and I both are from New York City. We lived there a long time. Have you ever walked through the Bowery? Downtown by the Williamsburg Bridge? What is that? The Valley of the Dry Bones. People sleeping in cardboard boxes, don't have shoes on. You know? I think in defense of using the Old Testament as a guide for teaching, it's only it is, guide for teaching. I mean, I could take Toni Morrison's book, and I have done this. I take Toni Morrison's book, Beloved, and use it. It's a fiction piece. Ugly, ugly history. Ugly stuff up in there. Woman killing her kids, you know. But it's a guide to tell you something. There's a message in the story of Beloved and why her mother killed her. There's a message for us right now to do that. And I think that's one of the things that I wanted to do. We'll come back to that. Brother Pugh, are you now settling in a little bit to look at some of this?
Yes, I have a slightly different interpretation. You know, this morning when I was thinking about defeating Trump, one of the first things that I thought about is that I needed a framework to understand what the problem was.
Okay.
And then once I understood, in other words, is Trump like a turtle, or is Trump like a ear of corn, or is Trump like a delinquent standing, you know, outside of the classroom? In other words, I needed a framework to understand what the problem was so I can figure out how to address it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I look at what Elijah Muhammad was doing and saying that that there's a metaphor between what was happening to the Israelites, or at least what they claim was happening to some Israelites in the Old Testament, and what is happening to blacks in America, that's a metaphor, that's a framework you can use. And so one of the things I do, I know I've got some very, very complex models, and I know that people don't have but a few seconds to listen to me talk. And so one of the things that I'm trying to figure out is, well, based on this person's experience, which metaphor can I use to best explain what I'm trying to explain to them?
Okay.
And I think that's what's going on. The business of prophecy, well, you know, the reality is that these kook Christians basically want to bring about Armageddon in the Middle East, so that, you know, they got this nonsense rapture that's going to happen, but it can only happen if something about Israel, some nonsense. But in any case, they're essentially creating that reality. So they're saying it's prophecy, but the reality is that the Bible is basically a blueprint for how to do evil on this earth.
Okay.
But so my point is that I see that kind of talk as a metaphor, as a mnemonic. In other words, when you've got some complex thing that you're trying to explain to somebody and you want them to remember it, then you've got to tell it in story, and you've got to tell it in a story that's animated so that it will capture them.
Right. That's what Aesop's, well, that was Aesop, but the African storytellers used, the griots used that process, didn't they? They always used animals as a way of explaining some of that.
Roger.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but my call dropped.
Yeah, I saw it. I saw you drop. Okay, right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that's why I called on Brother Pugh. We can come back to you in just a minute. Brother Pugh, you're right. You need to have an analogy to put to there. And that's what all great storytellers do. That's why they tell great stories, and they reference them to something to help you. That's why you see a lot of pictures with Trump as Humpty Dumpty, you know, to talk about his wall. And that wall was going to make him fall. And then when he falls, they ain't going to be able to put him together again. You know, good story for that, you know, kind of thing like that. Is that what you mean by that? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's precisely. In fact, one of the things that I do, or that any effective communicator is going to do, is ask the question, which metaphors are going to be most useful to my audience?
Exactly.
You know, in the Bible, they talk about Jesus using parables.
He did.
He's talking to farmers, and so as a result, his parables are farm-related, right?
Right.
On the other hand, when you talk to people, you know, in this computer age, people are always using, you know, computer metaphors because they know that the people they're talking to are likely to be familiar with them.
Right.
So, you know, that's one of the things that I saw in that.
I agree. Now, I think that originally I knew Brother Herbie White was on, and I did check it. I'm not sure if your phone is there. Brother White, are you there? Brother Herbie White? Well, maybe not. I'm not hearing him. I don't know if I'm hearing you, Brother White. Maybe you may, if your phone is muted. I know that your number here, this is your number, so I'll do that. Let me go back to Benicia Wood. Now, were you clear on what I was saying about the Old Testament in terms of how we might be looking at it from a different, we're trying to look at it as a spiritual guide when it really isn't? It's a spiritual guide, but it's a spiritual guide from within yourself. You can go in there and take those stories and apply them in a spiritual way to life. The Valley of the Dry Bones is a good way to teach you about homelessness and hunger and starvation among our people. Now, the history of it, that's brutal stuff. You know, if you understand, and based on what the story says and how those dry bones existed, you know, out of war and chaos, you know, then yes, you know. Is that kind of in light with what your response was?
I understand what you said.
Okay.
You know, and given the example of the Bowery, you know, yes, I saw it. Yes, I understand what you were saying. So what I want to say is that, and we've said this before in the program, you know, when the story is told by the conqueror, and I think Brother Pugh kind of alluded to that, you know, I came on, I had to dial back in, but when the story is told by the conqueror, then you're going to get a vicious, you know, story.
Right.
But when it's taught by the conqueror, it's going to be taught in a way that disempowers,
yes,
you know,
yes,
those that they're conquering. And so a point I want to make is that when the Old Testament, when black folk are taught, and anybody else that they, you know, want to conquer, when they're told that you need to take this literally, and in the Old Testament, you know, this angry, vengeful God, when you're told to take that literally and they don't know any better and they do, you really mess up a people's head.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you damage any type of spiritual empowerment.
Right. But it's not the book that's doing it. It's how people use the book that's doing it.
It's how it's taught. That's
right.
What I'm saying.
Yeah, that's right.
The conqueror is the one that organized that book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my whole point. That is not our version.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Bible that we were given is not ancient Kemet or whatever. You know, it's something that the European organized and constructed. So that's my issue with it. It doesn't mean that there are some things that are not. There are some spiritual messages in there, because I've studied some myself. So, mm-hmm. You know, like the Valley of Dry Bones, you know, talks about, you know, the spirit, the power of the spiritual force being breathed back into those bones and them coming to life. Mm-hmm. I believe that's possible.
Right.
Because I understand some about the world of spirit. But as far as the overriding message in the Old Testament with that, again, an angry, vengeful God, we were taught that as children. I was taught that, you know, when white missionaries used to come to Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
or whatever they were called, and teach us, little black children, about this God who was going to get us, you know, if we were not good. So we grew up being afraid of God. And the one that they call God. And I see that a lot in our communities, a fear of an angry, vengeful God. So that's the issue that I have, you know, how it is taught. Because, you know, whereas you and many others can explain this, you know, this is metaphor, it's not literal or whatever, parables, et cetera. The masses who are being taught in these churches, they're not getting properly, you know.
Right, and I agree. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I mean, that's just the way the literary experience is, and the way it's used, and how it has been used. It's used to manipulate. Like again, here's quoting Elijah Muhammad from his book "Message to the Black Man." He said, "The devils reared the poor so-called Negroes for 400 years, and put fear in them." When they were babies,
the devils
kept them apart from their own kind, coming in from abroad, so as to deprive them, as you said, just like you said, to deprive them of any knowledge other than what he, the devil, had taught them. And that's exactly what had happened in terms of sometimes in religion, you know, that it was used as a weapon, a tool to deprive
So we're on the same page, you know, and I'm not going to take up a lot of time, but I'm always concerned about the masses, you know, because those that can't think or that are told not to question or think, they'll just swallow any kind of nonsense that you give them or any your crazy interpretation.
Right.
They'll swallow it. And I see that. Exactly. And so I was saying for me, it bothers me. And if anybody should be preparing for some type of end times or whatever we're heading to. We are heading to something. I think it's pretty obvious. Oh, it should be us.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
And another quick thing, Doc, Marcus Garvey said that he would come back in a whirlwind with the ancestors.
Right, right.
And that's my prophecy that I'm holding on to.
That's prophecy.
Yes.
That's a whole lot of prophecy in those words.
Yeah, I'm holding on to that one.
Yeah. Very powerful piece. That's a very powerful word. And most folk haven't done what you've done. They haven't looked at what that really meant because they're not quite even sure what ancestors mean and how that is. And that's why we spend so much time pouring libations and talking about that in reference to our culture, getting children to understand. I see Brother Lance Jones from Greensboro, North Carolina, is on. I don't know if Brother Lance wanted to say something. I know he was on before. Sister Benicia, he is on the line. Brother Lance, you want to chime in this conversation?
Yeah, I was actually eavesdropping. Good evening, everyone. How are you all?
Okay, great, great. That's okay. It's all right to eavesdrop.
Good.
Any thoughts?
Well, I wasn't listening, but I just got back on, so I'm over here.
Okay, all right.
Mr. Dudley's home. We had a little meeting here.
Okay.
Deadly products, but the topic was economics earlier, wasn't it, or no?
Well, the topic is economic. Yeah, it does to a certain extent, but it's about vision and our vision for a political and economic agenda in 2020 and in this next decade coming up, and where that's coming from, and how is that being perceived as a people, as a community. And that's what we're looking at right now, more discussion on vision. We're looking at how vision is understood and how it was understood by our ancestors and how they use it. and so forth.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. So the thing is a very fitting topic, and we've had had some discussion this week on this same topic. In fact, I'm completing a book that in large measure talks about vision. And in the book, I talk about our worldview as a people,
right.
as an African people, notwithstanding religion and Republican. And, but we must begin to think as one people, both in our politics, and that when we speak with one voice, the person who best is able to answer our agenda politically, our spending power, and right. keeping the dollars in our community, supporting each other, each business, our children in the educational system. We must take it over and begin this, not just the STEM and the AI and all the modern technology, but mm-hmm. The know thyself, starting with the children, so we begin to turn these behaviors that we've adopted and learned in America, these among our enemies, among those who have taught us things that have not been developed and are no positive for us.
Right.
So exactly. we have to take control of the narrative. We have to change. We are responsible for changing the narrative,
right.
so that our children, our brothers and the boys, will start treating the little girls certain ways, that they get to know who they are and whose they are, and they get to know. One analogy I drew recently in the conversation, Denise was one of them, but one analogy I talked about was playing sport. Mm-hmm. So when we play sports, there's two teams. I likened it to territory and countries. So your job is to get down into my territory and take over.
Right.
My job is to get down into your territory. Well, if we have to use sports as a, let it not just be a game. Let us teach the science of warfare in that sense. And not that we want to use that term. The children, I get it. But I think you're hitting it right on the head. We must begin to think as one voting block, as one community. And we need to bring back the community. Yes, sir. Need to bring back the community in the real sense.
Right.
Where we... our houses, our community, we're responsible. We're shaping all the things that the community needs. Our stores, we patronize them. Our schools are built for our children. The curriculum there for our children. Our politics, when we vote, is in one voting block, not Democratic, Republican, or anything else. Therein lies the solution, one of the solutions, a major solution to our problem, our fragmentation, our division. We've allowed the as Marcus Garvey said, you know, we've wimped out and we've allowed these people to just take over the whole country, the whole world, and trick us. I'm paraphrasing.
Right.
But that's what I would add. I think, you know, I think it's a direction we must go in if we're to have longevity. They said that in 2050, Samaj, there's going to be more homeless blacks and more the condition of us in America. Will be, you know, nil.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a lot of work to do.
President
Adu of Ghana, who is doing a great job bringing us back home, and Kagame and Rwanda. A lot of work being done. And so it's a great time to be alive, and let's just do our part.
Just get to it, right. I agree 100%. Thank you so much, Brother Lance. I'm really glad you listened today. Appreciate you. I've enjoyed you over the other times that you commented on our program. And I welcome you always to listen, always to listen. I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 Eastern Time, 7 to 9 Central Time. We are here in our discussion. We are part of the TimeForAnAwakening.com network. Our program is sponsored by Motherland Media, which is a institution created by our good brother, Oshiemi Odelebu, who also produces a program on this network called African Perspectives. And he has a dynamic program that is held every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. Eastern to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Time for an Awakening Network. It's called African Perspective. Brother Oshiemi Adelabu. We appreciate him and all he's done. Following his program at 1 o'clock from, on Monday and Wednesday is a program called The Black People Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. The Black People Matrix, Brother Franklin Jones. And then on Friday evening, we have a new program that comes on. And I'm unfortunately, I know Brother Oshi had, was going to send me that material. And I know he was out of town and didn't get a chance to do so. But I want to be able to announce the young ladies' program so that we can have you take a look at it. It's a very dynamic program. It's a young lady that comes on, is presenting in the same perspective that we all do. But anyway, our call-in number here is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. If any of you in our internet audience is listening and would like to call in, make a comment, suggestion, you know, we're talking about vision. And we're looking at, we started our discussion based on two quotes, one coming from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Message from the Black Man, the other one coming out of the book of Genesis of the Old Testament. And so both of those are sort of like guiding, you know, our whole process here this afternoon, this evening. We're going to get deeper back into this. I want to come back to Brother Timothy. I'm so appreciative of him, member of the Nation of Islam, and have him also talk about something. But let's take just a quick break. We're going to come right back in about 2 or 3 minutes and finish this conversation up right now. Thank you.
No one knows who the Son of God is except the Father in heaven, and no one can know who the Father is except the Son, and those to whom the Son will reveal him. Until now you haven't known him as I do, but I have come, sent from him to you.
Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head? Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head?
I ain't Jesus, but I understand where Jesus was coming from. I can feel his passion because it is mine to be blessed in the womb of this earth and nurtured by the trees, the animals, the sun, the moon, and the stars, to be touched by them and dance in the rhythm of nature's flow. Oh, what a joy. I ain't Jesus, but I too am displeased with man's inhumanity to man, with the very thought of taking a life, turning and twisting it into a callous plant that hides from the sun and curses the stars at night. The wicked howl of madness finding residence in our souls makes the dark side bright and desirable.
Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head? Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head?
No, I ain't Jesus, but I love a good song. Fried fish on Friday, some real poetry, a great basketball game, watching black people rise and take charge of their lives and cherish the ancestors and the children we see every day, and recognize even a fool may have something wise to
is
say.
Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head? Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head?
And I'm working on my freedom. I'm working on my freedom every day. No, I ain't Jesus, but I know I can
is
be an angel.
Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head? Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter or in your head? Is he? Is he the living God, or is he dead? Is he in the gutter, or in your head? Is he the living God, or is he dead?
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
I'd like to thank one of my definitely special, very special groups. I've loved them all my life. The Last Poets, The Living God. The Last Poets, The Living God. We opened up earlier. Someone texted me just a minute and asked me what was the name of that opening piece that we did in the beginning of the program. It was by Sly Roby, one of the reggae drummers that played with the Revolutionaries and Bob Marley and a few other places, Third World. That was a piece by him called The River Niger, Sly Roby. So we always like to go back into that old Jamaican Rastafarian spirit of music as we move forward. A lot of the history that we've been talking about in terms of using the Old Testament and so forth comes out of the Rastafari ideas. Very clearly, and as Dr. John Henry Clark said, just don't throw that book away. There's some stuff in there that we need to get, some information that we need to have. Brother White, are you still on? I don't know. I tried to call you before. I'm not sure. I see your number still up here. I don't know where you're on. Are you there, Brother White? Herbie White? Okay. Yeah, he must have just left his phone off. Maybe he didn't realize he didn't go off the air. But that's all right. I appreciate his spirit. And what he's, I obviously have him on. Let me go back over here to Brother Timothy. I want to ask
Brother
Timothy or something
yes.
about, in terms of, and I know you read the message to the black man, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I have that right now in front of my face, and I have How to Eat to Live 1 and 2, Fall of America, right. Save Reverend Rod.
Can you give me, can you just tell us a few minutes, just in a few words, some other visionary ideas that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad wrote in that book, The Message to the Black Man, which is one of the greatest reads that I've ever witnessed. And very clearly, it is a power moving. I had a minister from the Nation of Islam here in Milwaukee, Mosque Number 3, Brother William. I'd asked him to come on once in one of our programs, and we talked about The Message to the Black Man, and we may do so again. Give us some more wisdom that you like, things that you liked in that Message to the Black Man that he was giving.
I think that Elijah Muhammad was a man who was very misunderstood, and I looked at him as a reminder. Some people looked at him as a prophet of this time, and he had prophetic vision.
Okay.
And
so give us some of that. Give us some things that he might have said that you can recall in terms of your studies.
Well, the mere fact he talked about America falling, and he said, if you don't believe it, look out your window. The message that he gave you about, he said that a clean glass and a dirty glass, his wisdom. And he spoke in parables.
Right,
he sure did. And right. And when what he did with the understanding of a God, he put him in human form. And a lot of people ran away from that. And he said he was taught by a man. He said, you went to the Bible, other men are inspired by men. And he said that spirit was dependent on matter. So he said everything else is a mystery, guys. So he brought you to reality just because white folks are selling you a dream that when you die, you're going to heaven. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Louis Farrakhan wrote the white man's heaven is the black man's hell because of what he learned from Elijah Muhammad. Mm-hmm. But I want to say something about how he experienced people, and definitely women. And I'm going to use even women that I thought were experienced and were somehow spiritualized and doing what they're doing before he was around. And I would say that Harriet Tubman, who we never met, I think she was a very spiritual woman and special. Mm-hmm. She somehow was guided by a higher power. Mm-hmm. You and I know that. And I'm also going to say, and we talk about the men in the Bible, we can't stop not talking about the woman. Mm-hmm. You know, she just is important. You know, I think also Ida B. Wells. Mm-hmm. Think about Ida B. Wells and her fighting.
All those powerful women during that time. Yeah.
Got it, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, listen, and the stuff that she did and the way she did it, the men didn't have the heart, right, the mindset, and the blueprint. Only she could have done that.
Right.
Only she. She's special, man. And we talk about the men and the message that we had that came before us. We can't forget about Madam C.J. Walker. Mm-hmm. That's another one was inspired. And I guarantee you, if you have people who understand prophecy, they have a role that they could pull out of the Bible that each one of them women could fit.
Right, right.
And Scheherazade Ali and what she did for us in the 20th century, right, to understanding ourselves as men and
that's
women.
That's a powerful connection. Very good, very good. Powerful connection.
Although, let me tell you something. The woman, the child,
I'm sorry.
Goes to the point where you think about Mary and Jesus.
Right, exactly. Let me go over here and ask Brother Lance, if you don't mind, him and Sister Yan. Both of them are very strong activists in our community, and particularly in the Greensboro community. And you all have worked with a lot of organizations, and you worked with some very strong African-centered black nationalist organizations, and you still are, and you still do that. In the work that these organizations are doing, do you still see that strong visionary spirit operating among the people as a collective? And I'm sure you may have one, two people that do have it, but I'm seeing as a collective. Do the groups operate collectively with spiritual vision? Do they work collectively? Do you see that? Can you actually see that in the work of the organizations that you're with? Let me ask you first, Sister Ayan, and then go to Brother Lance and ask him to answer that as well. Go right ahead. Sister Ayan? Sister Ayan?
Can you hear me?
Okay, now I can. Uh-huh.
Okay. I'll share this. I was just telling a brother about an hour ago that I was at a Kwanzaa celebration, and I saw two sisters that I hadn't seen in a long time, and, you know, sisters that I have a close bond with. And we started talking after the hugging and whatnot, and one sister started saying, you know what, I feel like something is coming down, and, you know, we got to get our passports, you know, and get up on out of here. We got to be prepared. And I said, you got to be kidding. I've been feeling that way for the past year, you know, or more, that I need to get out of this place. I need to get out of America. And then the other sister says the same thing. I've been feeling the same thing. And she had actually moved to Belize for a while. So I know that she had said in the past, she just feels like she needs to, you know, we need to get out, just like the movie Get Out. And over the past couple of years or so, I've heard mostly sisters, you know, we tend oftentimes to be very, very intuitive as black folk, but we are spiritual beings and can be very intuitive, if that part of us is alive and well. And many of us are feeling like we need to leave because something really heavy is going down.
Right.
So in terms of vision, you know, intuition, prophetic vision, there are some that are feeling that way. That's my experience.
There are some feelings that their spiritual vision in terms of knowing that something is going to change, something is going to happen.
A danger is coming, and we need to get out of the way.
Okay.
That's how I've been feeling, and others have echoed that.
Great. Right.
And been feeling that without me having a conversation with some of them.
Right. Brother Lance, are you seeing that? Brother Lance? I see he's still on, but I'm not sure. Brother Lance, I don't know if you have your phone on mute. Okay, I'll come back. I'll come back to Brother Lance. Let me go over here because I've often wondered, you know, as we look at working with a group here in Milwaukee, and we meet once a week, and we want to, and one of the things I do is I'm very observant at the meeting to see if our people are spiritually energized by the ideas of action and putting these actions in place as we work with our people. And in some cases, I will say, yes, they are there. And I watch some folk in our group do it. The person that's in the leadership part of it is very energized. He's very active in the community, very powerful young brother. But I look at the rest of the folk sometimes, and sometimes we can get real critical and we start criticizing every stuff. But I'm wondering, are we being driven by the prophecy of our ancestors? Are we being driven, as Sister Benicia was said in Garvey's statement about you catch him in the whirlwind? Because if you're going to catch him up in the whirlwind, that means you got to be in it too as you meet your ancestors. So there's somewhere our involvement in that whole process and all the rest of our prophets who have told us. And not necessarily religious prophets. I think that's the point. I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about spirituality. That's the difference in what we're looking at. And like I say, I see the Old Testament as a spiritual source. And there's a lot of other material that goes into the Old Testament that was obviously manipulated and removed that even gets deeper with some of the ideas and thoughts. It's called the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha was taken out by the Protestant movement, not used in a lot of ways. I wonder about that sometimes as we try to work in our community and move things. As we just finished our Kwanzaa celebration, was it a celebration? Was it a spiritual rejuvenation of our community for these 7 days? You know, did that happen? You know, did we come away from there with a sense of movement? Okay, the other thing I want to ask, and I'm going to go to Brother Pugh on this one, something that came across my eyes the other day. I was reading an article, and it made me think about how subtle this system continuously is doing things to tell us you're not worthy of being with us, and as a result of that, we are not going to respond to you or anything you do or say. And our vision enough to see that and get into it a little bit. And that's the some of the things that the NFL, the National Football League, is doing. And the whole thing that started with Kaepernick, you know, and the kneeling and what happened with that and the protest and the boycott, and we were going to boycott the NFL and not listen to any of the games. And, you know, we all know what happened with that. And this is not about football. I love the game of football. I'm a football fan. I always have been. Played it in high school, you know, college. Coached a team in the community. So I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the National Football League, which is an organization of billionaire white males who are clearly carrying over the power of slave-owning class of people that they come from. That's what I'm talking about. And the article was talking about the coaching staff and the fact that the NFL now is down to 3 black head coaches. And our head coaches are consistently being fired. I think the last head coach was one in Cleveland. He got fired. The brother out of the San Diego Chargers, I'm not sure. I think he was fired. and there's a whole bunch of others, and they're not replacing them with anybody. And then very clearly there are no black NFL owners. That's the problem, but that's not the problem I'm raising. The problem I'm raising is, why then are we running to the television every day and watching on Sundays and watching this mess? And don't get me wrong, I like it. And we've got some captives, some enslaved brothers. Well, I shouldn't say that. But anyway, some brothers that are well paid, that are played, that I'm happy for. I'm happy to see them in the roles that they are. But this is a symbolism of the enslavement system. We are out there rooting for the slave owners to keep our people in captivity. And really, that's what it is. And I would argue that anyway. That is a system of captivity carried over from the days of slavery. They buy and trade players. They buy and trade coaches. They're telling you. They're not hiding this. They're telling you, we're not hiring no black folks. We're not hiring no black coach because I don't think you can coach. You're not capable. Whereas 75% of the players in the NFL are black. But yet they're saying to us, you can't coach your own people. You don't have the ability to do that. And the bottom line is we need somebody that can win. And you can't do that. You're not capable. They said the same thing with the quarterbacks at one time. Very few black quarterbacks. If you remember back in the 70, 80 days, very few black quarterbacks. No black quarterbacks. I don't know when the first black quarterback was way back. But that's a statement. And the statement is that you are not mentally capable of being able to lead my billion-dollar organization. And that's what it is. Those teams sell for $3 and $4 billion, $5 billion, $7 billion. The Dallas Cowboys, $7 billion organization, $7, $8 billion. And they're owned by billionaires who if you trace their lineage, go back to the days of the old plantation. And clearly, Dallas Cowboys, Jerry Jones, and that whole thing, and a lot of those other teams, the guy that used to own the Carolina Panthers, that whole idea of who he was, the Washington Redskins, and some of the others, a lot of those teams trace their heritage back to the slave owning days. So, Jack, Brother Pugh, here's the question. What do you think is blocking the vision of our people to not see that? Is it too complicated of a concept to grasp? Why can't we see that? What's your thought?
Well, if you're saying that, why is it that our people are not boycotting the NFL?
Or responding in some way. I mean, even if it's not boycotting, responding in some way, when they put an article in the paper blatantly and the team owners tell you, we're not hiring no black folk and you can't make us do it. Goodell, he works at the behest of the owners. He doesn't have any independent decision to make them do it. You know, he can't even raise the issue. They pay his check. So, you know, he keep his mouth shut. You know, so why aren't we doing it then? What's stopping us from doing that?
Well, it takes, on the one hand, it takes someone who has the vision that they want to spearhead a movement for boycotting the NFL or, for that matter, pressing, you know, some kind of concessions from the NFL. And right now, no one has done it. But in terms of one of the things with our community is that, you know, you got to pick your shots and that, you know, there are any number of different problems. And one of the things about football or in sports in general is that when you want to transform people, you've got to capture them. You've got to capture their imagination. Okay. And that's one of the things that that athletics does. You know, Lamar Jackson, you know, all this talk about, you know, black quarterbacks and whatnot. I was noticing that all the comments about Lamar Jackson, they were essentially prepared to establish him as a great quarterback in the league of any other great quarterback. And in fact, who's the quarterback of Kansas City who was going to be in the Super Bowl?
No, Kansas City guy in Kansas City is I can't think of
his name. I'm blanking on his name now, but I'm hearing people say.
Andrew Jackson was with the, wasn't he with the, anybody online that knows that?
I mean, it's kind of ignorant, so my fault. But,
okay.
You know, I mean,
sure
I just got through watching the game the other day.
Right.
But the point I'm making, though, is that, you know, they've declared him as the best quarterback in football.
Okay.
And, in fact, this game, that the next game that's going to be played, is going to be one of the events that's going to demonstrate that. So I think what we've got to do is we've got to transform the mindset of the world. And one of the venues in which that can happen is football, is athletics.
Yeah.
What
you think, Brother Timothy?
Well, I like the brother from Kansas City. He's a brother, you know. I want him to do well.
Right, I do too. I agree. Yeah, I want him to do well, but still, you know, he works for a slave master. He works for the slave owning class, and they really are. That's where some of that money comes from.
Oh, yeah. Can I speak to that for a second about slaves?
Okay. Go ahead.
You know, I had said before that when we look at our society, we've got three kinds of people in our society. The first group I call criminals. And they look at the current society as the best of all possible worlds. And what they use is basically hate to essentially control others. That's what divide and rule is all about, is getting you to hate the other. Now, the second group of people, they don't look at the current world as the best of all possible worlds.
Right.
They look at the current world as the only feasible world. These people I call slaves or professionals. And the reason professionals is useful is that what it means is that it's a person who has a heart, but decides that strategically it's not to their advantage to use their heart. So they suppress what's in their heart. And they do what they're told. So they're pretty much organized by fear and greed, you know, carrots and sticks.
Right.
And then the third kind of people I call human beings, and they look at the current world as not the best possible world and not the only feasible world. They consider the current world as suboptimal. They operate from love. They operate from their heart. And what they do is look for opportunities to change things. Now, they recognize that, you know, you can't change everything overnight, but they recognize there are things they can do, and their job is to find what those things are. So when I look at NFL and so on, there are different perspectives that I can have on. So I'll let it go at that.
Okay, yeah, because definitely, and they're usually, I mean, that's just one example. And I use the NFL because it is a billion-dollar industry. There's not one team in the NFL that doesn't cost $1 billion or more. That's more than a lot of the corporate structures are. And that's one of the reasons that I use that, is the fact that it is being definitely driven by the African-American community, the players as well as a lot of spectators, you know, and people that pay, you know, that. And like I said, there are a lot of well-played Africans that are involved, but you know they're not.
Let me say this. You know, we may be able to prevent a civil war based on football. Mm-hmm. If you look at the performance of Joe Burrows, the quarterback of LSU, his outstanding performance. He comes from Southern Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
This is a heroin plagued white community. These are white supremacist Trump supporters,
mm-hmm.
Who pretty much after the Martin Luther King holiday have basically given up on America.
Mm.
Well, they essentially conceded basketball and football as essentially black sports and were moving away from them. But I think that one of the things that happens when you get a superstar like Joe Burrows or this fella Doncic in basketball,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, they're comparing to Michael Jordan, even though most people say that's just a lot of hype. But nevertheless, what that does is that here you have a white people who believe that there's no hope for them in America. And so as a result, you know, they embrace Trump and they're interested in sort of tearing America down and you know, I don't know, you know, what they call it, make America great again.
Right.
Well, that's because of inadequacy. But if on the other hand, they see somebody like them who's performing well in venues that they thought they had to concede to black people, that will give them the courage that that they can perform too, that unlike Trump, they don't have to give up and just figure out how they can cheat and steal from the system, but rather it's a way for them to, if they did their best, it's a way for them to excel.
Right.
So actually, I think that I think there's some real transformative potential that's available based upon, you know, the state of athletics in America today.
Okay. All right. Okay, Sister Yan, I want to just kind of get ready to close out with you and ask you for your perspective in terms of moving forward, in terms of the whole visionary idea. You are the womb. You do the work in the community. You're out grabbing young people, trying to generate to them. How would you encourage young people to stick with their visionary spirits that the ancestors used and was passed down to them in terms of listening and hearing and seeing and using that vision to empower themselves into action? What are some things that you might want to say to young people? If somebody's listening today who is like that, what would you say?
So honestly,
yes.
I want to say that if anybody's looking for hope or optimism, you know, from me, they won't get it.
Okay.
They will get a strong dose of reality, you know,
okay.
Because that's how I organize. And that leads me to what I would do. Excuse me. I don't do those types of things, inspire. I show people the hard reality in their faces and ask, what are you willing to do about this?
Right.
I don't want room for hemming and hawing in terms of how I operate. So when I show the raw realities and people can't ignore their lying eyes, I've been, along with my ancestors, very successful in organizing people once they see what's really going on. So that's what I do. That's just what I do. I say, look at the bare-ass truth and organize.
Okay.
You know, if you want something to be done, we got to do it. And I hope, do I have a minute? Because I want to share something.
No, go right ahead.
So I was looking at the marches. I guess they were in the early 60s, late 50s, whatever, where the black men had I am a man signs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just telling America, you know, I am a man. And you saw all those black and white, you know, the footage of black men, you know, marching, looking very solemn, you know, and almost kind of defeated, but just saying, in spite of all of that, I am a man. Those images just really have been seared into, that image has been seared into my mind. You know, that our men had to prove and tell, you know, this devilish system that they're men. As a woman, that always hurt me. But they still had the courage to do it, even though they had to look on the ground sometimes and not look white folk in the eyes.
Right.
To tell them that. And the push that this is who I am.
Right.
Now, fast forward to 2020. You have black men fighting to be women.
Okay.
First, they were fighting to be a man. I am a man. Let me stand up and be a man.
Right.
Now, in 2020, black men are fighting to be women.
Okay.
They're fighting to be transgender, accepted as transgender, gender accepted to, you know, put on a dress and heels and walk around on campus, you know, with their pocketbooks and whatnot.
Right.
Look at what has happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bare-ass truth that I'm talking about. All of that fighting that we've done, but behind, and we have done marvelous things. Mm-hmm. But behind the curtain, there's somebody who's been working at feminizing our men so that now they're fighting to be women.
That's right.
So that's what I talk, that's what I mean when I talk about putting the raw reality in our faces. We got to look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And then visions will start coming about, you know, the things that we can do, and creative thinking will reemerge. Because,
mm-hmm.
We got people that are busy,
right,
while we're making strides on us back.
Well, listen, this has been a wonderful idea. We're at the Bewitching Hour. I thank all of you, our listening audience, for being here, and those of you who are always consist of our community panel. I appreciate you. We'll be here next Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central. And we will hopefully have a wonderful and dynamic week, and we will see you next Tuesday.